Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Hello, everyone. You found us, and we found you. Masonic Effects. It's an absolute pleasure to have this opportunity again to sit down and talk, share some conversation, friendly atmosphere, whether it's a cup of cup of tea at a cafe outside on a summer's evening, or on a rainy day, which seems to be happening more frequently where I am, around a table, maybe with a fire going over in the corner, a glass of scotch, or a pint. Or nothing at all, lying back on a field with a friend, or sitting around with instruments, just singing and picking and playing. Hello. Every time, I don't want you to think that that anything that I could say or anybody else could say would completely define who or what we are. We're here talking about this. This phenomena, I think it's interesting to connect to every once in a while, and be reminded we are so much more than the category somebody or me or anybody else who would put you in or me in. It's always incomplete because. It's the complexity. If we just look at any aspect, it's more complex than the ideas we might pick up during our conversations. I'm not talking about the type where we're just the boldest boyish adventures trying to, best each other with the sarcasm and the ridiculous betterment. It's more of an attitude than it is factual. Do you remember those days? That feeling that we had when we all had to be right, but we all weren't. And you would get a punch in the shoulder if you were too irritating, when you embarrassed the bully, when, somebody, there was a lot of thoughtlessness going around then, but such is life. The boy eventually grows and becomes the man. We aren't the same anymore. We're not the same as what we were. But we're familiar. We know the boyhood is back there, but even our recollection of that so very long ago is, even our recollection of a single event is, it's a bit dodgy, I'm afraid. Because because of matter of will or that sense of supremacy or the accuracy. It's just the way our minds work. We tend to, and gratefully so, you know, it's part of it. We tend to embellish the good parts, and in our own maneuvering, what we see as the good part, whether it's defining, particularly things that define us, like some tragedy. For some folks, it is a life-changing event. And others, it can be on different levels. It can be, you know, physically, of course. But the scars, we know that some scars are not visible. They run very deep. And the containment of them, we see too many examples of, you know, people striving and doing remarkably well in a way that makes the rest of us question, how would we do if we were in those circumstances, begin to doubt our own strengths and capabilities, but at the same time also demonstrate to us the capacity, the potential. That there are those things that go on where we make choices, where we cope, where we don't really have a choice. And somebody comes along later and says, oh my goodness, you're wonderful. You're so strong, but you know the truth. We get by. We do what we have to. And controlling the thinking, you know, our thoughts, we always want to go back and pivot around unhappiness and cruelty. Well, we know it that to the kind of sensibilities that we're talking about. It taints it. For me to say no one deserves that, it's sort of meaningless, isn't it? Nobody deserves it, but it happens. The bigger question is not what to do about it, it's when. Do you expect it? Well, of course, I would think. It's inevitable. It scares me when people can experience these tremendous tragedy and then just pop back up as if, you know, we can just somehow erase that part. No one does. No one does. We cope in our own way. I'm from the school of Stoics, like many of you. You just suck it up and move on. Suck it up, buttercup. Life is always full of the unexpected, and to think otherwise. But with age, we begin to practice and notice some things. It's not instant, you know. It's not that it can instantly dissolve the tensions and then move on. But it happens quicker and quicker and quicker. You compartmentalize, I call it. Psychologists have some lovely terms, like neurology has a incredible term, but they're kind of scary. They have their own language. They compartmentalize, you just move on. It's the format, it's the basis for this, our show today. The narrative here, expressions, gives you a bit of a hint where we're going. How we express the craft is what we're going to talk about. Not that you have to. We don't turn these things on and off. And if I was to say to you that we are all self-aware all the time, you know that would be. I would be reluctant to ever say something like that. We are sometimes, but can we put on an optimistic demeanor? Yeah. And does a smile have an effect on us? Yeah. And does it have an effect on the people that come around us? Well, yeah. After people get over the shock of that foolish old guy over there that's smiling for no apparent reason, he's driving and he's happy, he's experiencing, he's happy about something. That is a set point for us. You know, we for this species that we are, we love that. It's attractive. It's like it's almost mischievous. Maybe some of that happiness will will spill over. And oftentimes, yeah, it does. It does. I'm not talking about that malevolent nonsense, you know, that we have to put in cages and watch. That is there. But that's such a small, sensationalized part of the, it's like, you know, thinking about living in a jungle. There's certain dangers. And so we don't box our vulnerables up and say, we're going to keep you safe from all of that. No, that just distorts who they feel think they are and distorts their life. No, we're not. This isn't about preppers, you know, talking about needing to prevail over the misery that's coming. No, no, no. It's about teaching the risk, giving our young people the tools that they need. Information. So we've lasted for such a long time. Right now we're looking deeply into the mirror and looking at the cost of the unwanted cost, the indifference to what we've done to the environment in the meantime. But it's caught up with us. How many hundreds of thousands of years of human history we were relatively benign. Up until, what would you say, the Industrial Revolution? And then things seem to literally light up. And now we stoke those fires for a long, long, long time, at least long in one man's lifetime. But in the lifetime, in the period of existence of the Earth, 26.5 billion years old now, new tools being created, new technologies being created, showing us things we didn't know existed before. And it's just so tempting to open up that Pandora's box. UFOs is you know, trying to get a toe in the door. Yeah, it's a way of, I think, delegitimizing the, it's the whistling in the graveyard kind of thing. You know, well, we don't really, it's speculative. These constant hurricanes and driving floods and droughts and temperatures that are just been predicted. Oh, my goodness. And I'm not talking about biblical kinds of prediction and pestilence. But, you know, sometimes when it makes you wonder, doesn't it? Yeah. The science was and is there for us to employ, particularly around the dangers. Now, some you know, when the boys often die very young because they're a bit thoughtless about the risk. Man, I'm brave enough. As soon as I know the risk, I'm going to take it because that's going to show that I'm somebody important. And I'm somebody in control. And I stand out from the crowd because the cautious will stand back and I can do the bold and usually die. Yep, sadly. Or not. It's I'm not going to say that life, that there is a certain period of life that is right and the rest is wrong. Is it right for everybody to live to be 95 and wrong for people to live to be 20 or 28. I'm thinking about some of the, in my culture, well-known singers, popular singers, 28 years old, God. No, this just shuffles it up a little bit and puts all of those things into context. Now, where we go with that, I find listening to you talk about your sense of the context and the importance of it, I find that fascinating. I do. Now, I can't, if you ask me why I find that fascinating, I would have to sit down with you and think about it. There's reasons. I'm not necessarily going to get into them today on the show. But I think in some ways it's validation. It's like validation. The older I get, the less the less I seem to be in need of the validation, let's put it that way. I like it, like the rest of us, I do like it, but I'm comfortable. I know things, I can accept things, you know, you're flawed. I'm not a piece of crystal that you can shine a light through and there's nothing in it. I have those flaws like everybody else. Am I the same? Oh my goodness, no. Different today than I was then, just like you. And the messaging that we pick up from the craft is it's so darn wholesome, you know. But and at different levels, it's wholesome, like the messaging of a poet, you know. You remember Coleridge, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner? Melville, when you're reading, when the tortured mind and the metaphor with this monster that's out there hunting him, that personal relationships that need to dominate, overcome the demons. Not that. The stuff that's with us every day, but not necessarily front and center every day. Thank goodness, well, for me. When we do see people that are become preoccupied with what's happened to them and with that sense of doubt, always the question and never the certainty. And are we able to influence? Yeah, absolutely. But not by barking at people, not by telling them, but by showing them. It's wherever, whatever our starting point is, with some, only a few exceptions that are so extreme that that science needs textbooks to describe them. Those aberrations. I think I wouldn't stop the contemporary communication, the fluid communication that's improving. I would never stop that for a second, but there's, like everything else, there's an unexpected consequence. What fascinates us? Well, you have a car accident, everybody slows down to take a look. That's our fascination. That's us. And we might get, you know, if you're a commuter, you're thinking, my Lord, just get move past, you know, your foot on the accelerator. It's like somebody's tragedy. The crews are there to help move along. Do you need to see the go? Is that really news that there's that accidents happen and people do thoughtless things? Then is that really newsworthy? But it does something, doesn't it? It does something to a lot of people. Maybe it gives us a sense of maybe that's the moral superiority, or morally superior to you, because I know enough not to be looking. You know, there's a sense of privacy. There's no dignity. You know, let's leave a family or leave people with their dignity intact without gawking at them. They're not there to entertain, or there's nothing salacious I need. You know. You can do that. That's just contemporary setting. No state or authority really it sets good taste. But our cultures do set limits, and there's some things that we find usually about the rights. Yeah, often about the rights, like the rights of children and women, that's not going to go away. That will be with us absolutely forever. And where we see that until women are in control, until they define the control that they feel is warranted, whether that's around equality or affirming rights or mastery or all of it, that day is somewhere in our future. The I was thinking we're coming up to the anniversary of Hiroshima, and I'm only going to touch on this very briefly, the degradation of humanity. It reminds us that there are limits, and we ought not to go over them, because the price that we pay is, and the price for all the people involved in that, isn't paid off once. It goes on and on and on. And even at the time, we wondered why and what is this hell we're creating? So sit back. We have a pretty good program today. If you find things that are exploring some of your thoughts or pulling at some of your ideas, wonderful, wonderful. It, after all, is an ongoing conversation. And I've been listening to you again, and on my own peril. And you're, again, you're interesting. You're still reading and you're still thinking. And the way, even if it's a glimpse, the music that you listen to, the movies that you watch, the books that you read, the lectures that you attend, what you take away changes, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. And just listening to you describe them is wonderful. Just recently, I was out with some fellows from a very rural area, lovely, but different than. I'm more of one of those suburban kinds of creatures, urban kind of creature. But they don't have we didn't share the same need for privacy. They're more gregarious and good fellas in their own way, good enough that. Putting a mirror in front of them, I don't think would serve much purpose other than they would take out their comb and doll themselves up a bit or straighten their tie. We have there was that spirit of togetherness that was undeniable, and we were part of that. And does that go far? It should. If it doesn't, it ought to. Because in the back of my experience, there's those fellows that are not drawing much attention to themselves, that have troubled thoughts and really are quite good at camouflage and don't bring much attention to themselves. These are the fellows that it's not everybody that's recovering from their own a way of coping with a 12-step program. The majority of people recover in their own way, privately and the hard way, and still carry baggage with them because they just haven't found somebody to communicate with. And that communication embellishes, it expands. It expands us and our understanding of ourselves when we're in the presence of others. Yeah. And so we have a... So I'm here. I'm going to recreate a mood here. The poetry today. We'll talk a little bit about the significance of poetry in life, just because it's like if you're joining me at the opera, we don't really sit down over our glass of champagne and start talking about the importance of opera. We're experiencing it, right? We're taking it in. We may be talking about the particular composer or the composition, whatever, but the atmosphere, you know, the energy, you know, that feeling. You have that same feeling in the art gallery. When you're there and you found that comfortable seat and you found that there's some expression of art that it has connected with you and it's had that effect. And this art artists have done for a long, long time. And we might sit and you may sit like I do and scratch my head and wonder, how do you know? How do you know? And then I think, well, how do we not know? How does Shakespeare capture the us and explore us so frequently? He was paying attention to the detail, just like those artists and designers and, you know, choreographers and the odd. I don't think the Freemasonry was the ground floor of much of this, but it recognized that a long time ago. The thinking recognized that there's so much going on that attention to it makes a man interesting and interested and aware. And if we share those ideas, what could possibly go wrong? Sit back. I've got music for you today. This is an old tune. This is something called Free Spirits. It's by Mary Lou Williams Trio. I don't know if you've ever heard about this group. It's, you decide. Thanks for sitting. This ought to be fun. I think we can handle an evening with that group, don't you? Just saying. Expression. Would I give up all that I am to be Hiram? Here I am attempting to personify some parts of ritual. Our conversations stay at a superficial level until we begin that ubiquitous journey. Guided by your mentor, step by step, we take up the persona of a very special man, the last remaining idealist, Hiram. Pushing aside greed and domination, we began to see the possibility of being in a community of shared values that took apart ignorance and prejudice. The honor system. Morality was curated, but not described. You and I were given tools, taught how to use them, and left to apply them to our conscience. What we do and how we express masonry follows our gradual absorption of a technical nomenclature. We know we strive. Living in the moment, contemplating, we learn that the greatest satisfaction a man can experience is helping others. Men have always expressed masonry in their own way. We are generic as leaves on a tree and as unique as each leaf. I don't know. Fractal geometry apply to us. What holds us together is found in ritual. It's found there. For some, it is performance. For others, it is to understand. For the lodge is the benefiting from the thoughtful contributions of one and all. The lodge, it is like that. So rehearse ethics in conversation with your mates to apply them, the ethics, in the profound world where masonry learned is then put to use. Your researches will enrich thinking. Your conversation will influence. And because it's private, gradually assuming traits of a Mason is a different way of looking at reality. I mean, it isn't pretty. We have a duty, yet it comes with a capacity to rationalize why we cannot live the good life. Once you begin, never give up on yourself. Keep an open mind. Catch yourself when you feel it closing, and to find the answers you seek, explore where you haven't explored before. You are one of those travelers who wrote about the beauty of their journey as a guide to us, to the rest. It helped a poor boy like me understand spirituality. How has it helped you? I wonder. Poetry, eh? Let me describe a little bit of this. Yes, and if you're a bit of a fan of Pythagoras, yes, you'll appreciate some of this, especially when, you know, he did so much for us to deepen our understanding of music, the mathematics and the precision, the beauty of it. And then he applied it to the universe. If he didn't, then some genius applied it for him. And thank you all. Here, this is from, I recommend this. This is Tears in the Fence, and it's an independent international literary magazine. You can get it through the internet. And this comes from that work from March 14, 2022, the post. Poetry, it explains, is like music, and it can provide a kind of atmosphere to echo or assure a reader, share in their mood, or provide one. It can also, like novels, serve as a kind of escape, allegory, or humor as we face or need respite from life's difficulties. But what comes also, people come back to poetry for insights into the deeper questions of life and nature and connection and existence and the cosmos. You don't have to, but you can. It's not that poetry answers the great questions, but that it asks with us and participates somehow in our being. The author here has thought about the deep reflective poetry of John Donne, Death Be Not Proud, poems by Gerald Manley Hopkins in moments of depression, but also Doubt About Belief, and then a reconnection with the creator in Carrion Comfort, Carrion, or Frost's poems, which are on one level simple observations of nature, natural spaces. And then he passes along on walks and another level that have to do with how he decides to live and direct his life, or how he keeps on going. When we think about contemporary poetry, we think these are the things which draw us to authors like Anne Carson, whose poetry contains characters and philosophy and history and the confusion of every everyday being, and both interrogates our own existence and allows us to watch somebody else doing the hard work of wandering along, struggling with life and rejection and meaning and time. It's like cruise control, isn't it? Or Srikanth Reddy's Facts for Visitors, and the native Georgian poet Andrew Zawocki, and the deep beauty of their poetry. Poetry connects us simultaneously to ourselves and to the world and universe that we're part of. It's a deep form of art, which in this current time is one of the strongest examples of hope, or methods of hope. This is why poetry is, for many of us, fundamental and for society. You look around at the struggle people are experiencing. Would you think that they might benefit from a different way of thinking about themselves and the world around? Well, I'm just asking. Do you think that if they're drawn to intolerance and the pessimism, that these descriptions, these brief paragraphs, offer a different perspective? Would people benefit? Would it directly impact their sense of struggle? I put that to you. That's poetry in general. I like to think that we're sharing it because it's an attention to detail. And your attention to detail through your eyes, in your mind, through your senses, is a way of me understanding mine, because yours is yours and mine is something different. This is the work of today. We're looking at a poem called Envy. Oh, yes. Envy. This is by a writer, Mary Ann Lamb. But she was born on the 3rd of December, 1764. And she's known. She did a lot of work with her brother, Charles. And they're together, they produce this material. She's well known, Tales from Shakespeare. And some of us can identify. She came from very humble beginnings, born in a poor family, it said, had little formal education. But she helped support the family by doing needlework. And if you'd like to, you need to look into sort of a Victorian tragedy. Her mom was an invalid who was entirely dependent on Mary's care. And on September 22, 1796, she was in her 20s, in a fit of madness, Mary stabbed and killed her mom. That's a statement in itself, isn't it? It's happening around us even now. How do you end the suffering of a loved one? It's believed that there was an hereditary strain of mental illness in the family, and that Mary's illness was precipitated by overwork. When she was declared temporarily insane and placed under the guardianship of her brother, Charles, and for the rest of her life, she was subject to recurrent bouts of mental illness. Remember, this is back in the day where asylum was there not to protect us, but to protect the people from what we did to them when they're in that vulnerable state. It's somewhat disgraceful that we still find vestiges of that in our understanding and treatment of mental illness even today. However, here, this is an interesting poem. So here's the analysis. You look for it. Here's all the smart people are saying. This is from Loughborough University professor Dr. Oliver Terrell. Envy, he explains, is a poem by Mary Lamb, who is best remembered for her tales from Shakespeare. But she's also a fine poet. Envy, she presents to us an important truth about the nature of envy and the futility of believing the grass is always greener on the other side. Perhaps he explains the best way to offer an analysis is to go through each of its stanzas in turn, three stanzas, and provide a summary of Mary Lamb's argument at each point. In the first Envy, the title, we already know its theme. Envy is the longing for something which somebody else has, but we don't. Envy, of course, is viewed as sinful by Christianity and one of the seven deadly sins, but it's dealt with differently in different faiths. In envy, Ms. Lam makes a virtue of resisting envy rather than commanding us not to covet what other people have. She encourages us to see the pointlessness in wishing we had what somebody else has, urging us to discover the wonderful things we already have. In that first stanza, she turns to nature to furnish her with examples. We know the rose is a beautiful flower, and countless poets have praised a woman's beauty by likening her to a rose. But the rose tree is not designed by nature or God, if you're of a particular persuasion. In order to grow violets, it grows roses and does so very well. Does the rose tree look at the violets on a nearby tree and sigh, saying to itself, "How I wish I could grow violets like those"? Of course it doesn't. It just gets on with the business of bearing roses. The same goes for the lily. Besides, even if those rose trees did sigh and wish it could bear another flower than a rose, it would wish in vain. A rose tree belonging to grow violets isn't suddenly going to start bearing violets just because it's that way and fine. It's in its nature to bear roses and will continue to do so. And should it fret, we would suppose it ne'er had seen its own red rose. And she continues this into the second. The rose tree did fret or worry, wishing it could start bearing some other flower. Anyone looking at it would conclude the rose tree was blind to its own beauty. How on earth, rose tree, can you long to bear some other flower when you can grow these beautiful roses? You must be mad. And this is to say nothing of the pleasant scent of the rose, its natural perfume, especially after it's rained. Like such a blind and senseless tree as I've imagined this to be, all envious persons are, with care and culture, all may find some pretty flower in their own mind. And finally, the message. All envious people are like such a hypothetical rose tree, looking at others and thinking, "Why can't I have what they have?" And these people are blind to their own talents or qualities. This imagined rose is oblivious to its beauty and scent. Envy is an emotion that Shakespeare captured several centuries before Mary Lamb in his sonnet 29. We'll bring that up later, eh? The rose tree is not made to bear the violet blue, nor a lily fair, nor the sweet mignon. And if this tree were discontent or wished to change its natural bent, it all in vain would fret. And should it fret, you would suppose it ne'er had seen its own red rose, nor that after a gentle shower it ever smelled its rose's scent. Or it could ne'er be discontent with its own pretty flowers. Such like a blind and senseless tree as I've imagined this to be, all envious persons are, with care and culture, all may find some pretty flower in their own mind. Some talent that is rare.
finally,
our work in history swings around to an understanding of Dutch Freemasonry being influenced by Britain. It's as if, you know, the imitator is highlighting the best ingredients of the original, like Kabuki theater, the male performers of Kabuki theater, picking up the essence of a woman, and over time being looked at as being able to, as able to express that essence much better than a woman herself. I'll leave that with you. Here, let's just jump into this one. Still the 18th century. La Bien-Aimée Lodge. The identification with the ancient world was easily made among these Dutch brothers whose formal education remained distinctively classical and humanistic. There was also the shared belief that the Freemasons had inherited the traditions of the original Masons, skilled in the art of building among all people and places, beginning with Solomon's Temple to that of the Roman, Greek, and other learned emperors, being well known as architects and mathematicians. This lore formed the subject of orations and also the content of the Masonic Catechism, on which new Masons were quizzed before the assembled brothers. The Masonic identification was ultimately not with the ruled, but with the rulers. King Solomon ruled Israel according to Masonic virtues that were not inherited by his successors. Yet other virtues, more modern than ancient in their historical importance, were routinely discussed, among them freedom. Without it, there would be no unity. Freedom cannot exist without virtue expressed by good laws. It is invoked most frequently in discussions of elections, but also simply to describe the Dutch. They are freedom-loving. It is a characteristic that Freemasonry claimed to reinforce. By the mid-1760s, the Masonic virtues are being equated with the restoration of man's natural state. End quote. The orator exhorted about the main reason why Freemasonry was so well received among the enlightened. The natural state of humanity is therefore restored perfectly. No disguise will be tolerated among them. These sentiments being expressed might be classified as Rousseauian, but should we not reverse the order of influence? Rousseau? Rousseau, just a little aside, Rousseau's notions about natural human kindness and the emotional foundations of ethics are still at the core, in many of ways, of today's moral outlook. And much of modern political philosophy builds on the foundation of Rousseau's On Social Contract from 1762. As part of his genius, Rousseau provided a vocabulary for sentiments that predated him. We should remember here that Rousseau de Missy, the founder of the original lodge in 1735, and its master into the 1750s, was a self-described pantheist and a republican. Not least, the Dutch Republic possessed a tradition of opposition to absolute authority. When celebrating the 200th anniversary of Leiden University, created during the late 16th century revolt against Spain, in thanksgiving for Leiden's having resisted a long and desperate siege by the Spanish, the brothers of Le Bien-Aimée reminded themselves of their brave ancestors. Identification with the ancient world. the commonness was the familiarity, I should say, was because many of these brethren shared classical education and humanistic values that came out of that emphasis. It's something to think about when we're designing or moving lodges forward. And I think it's important to consider the educational background, and particularly how the candidate or the applicant is rubbing shoulders with the liberal education. Here. This is Fred Hirsch Trio. Lovely song. It's called The Man I Love. There you have it. There we have it. We reach that point again. End of a program. Maybe we do envy that sense of lore. But we know that it's the ideal. We're thinking about the history of and the effects of functionally illiterate tradesmen, a guildsman. The history, I think, that's maybe ideal, but the history, I think, is also very, very, very interesting. The guild was able to survive by changing its ways and embracing the more well-educated and well-heeled merchants that brought in resources, that kept masonry, the formation of masonry in the guilds in place. When they were unable to do that because of shifts in time, it was hard to find big work sites because cathedrals were not being built. These major structures were not being built in the same abundance. So you didn't need so many master masons and apprentices running around. We'll come back next week and we'll see where this takes us. I'm happy to say we're looking quite good for 2023 and already planning into 2024. You've made this possible. Yes, each one of you have made this possible around the world. My goodness. Brazil and Japan and New Zealand. And now the curiosity of Masons somewhere in Russia. Can't pinpoint where. Or people that are interested in Masonry somewhere in Russia. And Britain and Greece and the United States and Canada and Zambia, of all places. Yeah, for me, I say, of all places, the continent that is rapidly developing and reaching its or reestablishing its prominence, I would say. We get by the best we can. And thank you for sitting in and joining us today here on Masonic Effects. commit those acts of random Masonic kindness and be sure to include yourself. Thanks.